asymmetrical microstates are. And that's a lot of what my talk is about. So this is work, some of it done, more recent work done in collaboration with my postdoc, Stefano Masai. And it's a string theory of supertubes. So the simplest, and maybe the original sort of microstates, which were constructed by Samir and Oleg Lunin, are these objects called supertubes. They carry two out of the three charges of these three-charged black holes that we've been talking about all morning. And so here's an overview of what I'll be discussing. A brief review of the three-charge system. We've gone over this several times already, so I'll be very brief. I'll describe the supertube, a very particular supertube, for which we've been able to construct not just the supergravity solution, but in fact an exact classical string theory solution. So tree-level string theory is under complete control. That will lead us to a discussion of what the excitations of this object are, and which of those excitations are geometrical and which are stringy, and how much more or less entropy we'll get by considering the stringy excitations as opposed to the supergravity excitations. All right, so as I said, we've already seen this several times before. The sort of canonical microstate counting example constructed by Strominger and Vaffa consists of compactifying string theory on a 5-torus that's very asymmetrical. So a T4 is of order string scale, and one circle is macroscopic. As a consequence, the low energy excitations in this system will carry momentum mostly along the macroscopic direction. So the light excitations consist of momentum that's running along a direction we'll parameterize by y. The coordinates along the T4 are microscopic, and so we'll more or less dimensionally reduce along that direction, so down to 6 dimensions. And so we'll have a y-circle, time, transverse radial direction. Those three package up into a local ADS3 near the core of the brain sources. And then there's an angular S3. And so when you go to low energies, the geometry that's sourced by these brains is an ADS3 black hole times a 3-sphere of angular directions in the transverse space, and then a rest of the compactification, which plays very little role. This BTZ black hole is dual to a thermal ensemble of states in a 2-dimensional CFT. The coordinates of that CFT are time and this y direction. Okay, now the entropy of that thermal ensemble, which you can compute either using the Bekenstein-Hawking formula or from the asymptotics of the density of states of the CFT, gives you an entropy which is the product of the three charge quanta. And then if you allow the system to carry angular momentum on the transverse S3, the effect of S3 rotation is to remove some amount of free energy available to make momentum excitations. So there's a picture, a crude picture of the phase diagram, which is that wherever this radical is positive, then you have a semi-classical black hole entropy formula. There's a macroscopic horizon area, and the ensemble, the typical state in that ensemble is a black hole. There are, however, states in the CFT that lie outside that bound, down to the BPS bound of states of minimal energy, and also having some polygonal bounds as well. And everything in the blue shaded region is not a macroscopic BTZ black hole, but contains other stuff. In particular, it contains smooth geometrical states that we'll discuss. Okay. So in the CFT dual, we go back to the bound state of brains. They contain string-like objects, which are basically the places where the brains intersect each other. And if you say we construct some twisted boundary condition where these strips wrap into each other as you go around the y direction, then you can create inside the bound state objects where the length of the box in which the momentum excitations are living is sort of parametrically larger by amounts of order of the brain charges, parametrically larger than the size of the Y circle from the point of view of gravity. So there's a kind of a long string sector. And if you ask about this entropy, it's basically the 1 plus 1 dimensional entropy of the gas of momentum excitations on this box, which is N1, N5 times longer than the nominal size of the box as seen by supergravity. So the question we're going to ask is this long string physics some artifact of this dual CFT description at weak coupling? Or can you also see it in supergravity as some sort of emergent structure? Okay. So the recent work that David reviewed earlier this morning builds certain special coherent excitations by starting with some two-charge microstate and building some coherent excitation to add energy to the system to push you up into the black hole regime. So that's a construction within supergravity of very particular microstates, but they're, from my perspective, not really very generic microstates, because the excitation you do to go from the blue phase to the black hole phase is a very coherent excitation, exciting a small number of modes a macroscopic number of times. And that's certainly not thermal.
Sorry, can I ask you, so can I think of this is in terms of a real black hole, or is this really still very abstract?
It's a theorist's laboratory, okay? So you're taking near extremal black holes in six-dimensional supergravity, effectively. And so any near horizon structure of an extremal black hole has an ADS-like throat. And so this is a description of that ADS-like throat and the effective degrees of freedom that describe it.
So I guess I just want to see how much I can push this. So, I mean, in classical GR, we have this extremality limit, and you cannot spin things beyond that. So are you saying that there are states that is...
You can spin things beyond that. They're just not black holes, right?
They're just not
planets orbiting stars, okay? Or,
right.
Okay?
They are disjoint, right? So there are really two different islands of the phase space. So here these are connected. So the question is, are there things that are, can you take Andromeda and continuously make it the black hole, basically?
Not, yeah,
there.
Shed its angular momentum.
But dynamically you could do it, but they're not the continuum of states. But okay, so that's kind of what I'm trying to understand is.
Okay. So the phase diagram is states that carry two charges and are extremal, supersymmetric, they live down here, okay? And so the set of all states that live on this unitarity bound and were constructed by Smir, Lunin, and Matur and later work, and they're objects called supertubes. The problem is that the typical such geometry has very large stringy corrections. And this more recent work on building three-charge states by making coherent excitations of the two-charge states are built fundamentally on these objects. So it would pay to understand these more primitive two-charge states in as much detail as possible if we're going to get towards understanding what the typical state looks like. Okay, but the problem is that the typical such two-charge state is very stringy. So how do we deal with that? Well, we try to construct it within string theory, not within supergravity. So ideally, we'd like to construct an exact world sheet description of the world sheet conformal field theory that describes strings propagating in the background of this ADS3 cross S3 geometry. Okay? And well, what's ADS3? It's the group SL2R. What's S3? It's the group SU2. So a nice natural playground is to look at string theory on group manifolds and then see if we can construct something which has the right geometry to be one of these supertubes. And so the answer is yes. You enlarge yourself not to think just about ADS3 cross S3 cross T4, but you add an additional R11. But you get yourself back down to 10 dimensions by gauging a subgroup of the group manifold. And so this is a 10-dimensional target space. But by playing around with the embedding of the denominator group into the numerator group, one finds a variety of supertubes, including ones that carry the two charges, NS5, five-brain charge and momentum, five-brain charge and string charge, as well as spectral flows of these geometries. Spectral flow is just a solution-generating technique where you basically take a base solution and you start spinning it up. So you spin it up on the S3, and so the system carries some amount of angular momentum. So these null gauge, I should have said the currents that you're gauging in the denominator, they're null currents within this 10 plus 2 dimensional target space. And so this structure appears to be a very valuable tool for studying the near horizon structure. So a particularly simple class of configurations, and the ones that are actually described by the group theory approach on the previous slide, are to take a 5-brain and put a particular chiral wave of the transverse scalars. So the brain is living in a 5+1 dimension. It has a 5+1 dimensional world volume. It has 4 transverse directions. So take 2 of those transverse scalars and just excite them coherently with this profile. And what that describes is a 5-brain that's executing some kind of spiral in the transverse space. And as you can see from this, the spiral is something which carries angular momentum in the transverse space, but it's also carrying some momentum running down the compact direction. So this is something that has 5-brain charge, momentum, and angular momentum. Okay. Now, there's a very rich fine structure in the source geometry, which is invisible to supergravity. So as you make the spiral more and more flat, the strands of the 5-brain become ever and ever closer together. And that structure is at a scale which is very substringy. And so you don't see it in supergravity. If you like, the multiple moments that describe all of this structure go like r to the minus n5, where n5 is the macroscopic charge being carried by the 5-brain. So you just don't see it in supergravity. Okay. And these superstratum constructions that were described earlier this morning are things that wiggle the smear geometry within supergravity. And what we're expecting is that when we dig into the details, that there's a lot more structure by wiggling this stringy substructure, and that much more of the entropy is going to be lying there. So what's an example of that? Well, it's been known for a long time that the thermodynamics of these 5-brains is governed by something called little string theory. It's basically that there is some string-like structure within the 5-brain. It's not the ordinary fundamental string of string theory, but it's some kind of more non-perturbative object. And its description in this particular spiraling 5-brain is that you take another of the objects in string theory, a D2-brain, so a membrane-like object, and it can stretch between the strands of the helix. And but in order for it to come back on itself, you have to keep winding, you know, you have to take the two bits of the membrane, and you have to stretch them around until they close back on themselves. But the membrane has to go around this spiral a whole bunch of times before it wraps around and meets itself again. So this is exactly the way string theory gets this structure that is multi-wound over a compact direction. So instead of this direction being compact with some radius A and having a box size which is of order A, you have to wrap around this thing a macroscopic number of times before it comes back to itself. So the size of the box that momentum excitations on this membrane see is something which is macroscopically larger than the size A that's seen in supergravity. So we can construct these solutions for any amount of the winding. So there's some integer k, which describes how many times the brain is wrapped around this spiral. And as we crank that up, two things happen. The size of the box that momentum excitations on this W brain sees is k times longer than the nominal size in supergravity. At the same time, when you do that, the angular momentum that's carried by the state is coming down towards zero. It gets divided by a factor k. So what you see is that the excitations on the brain become lighter and lighter. At the same time, you're coming closer and closer to the threshold of black hole states at this extremal juncture down at the bottom of the parabola. Okay, so you're starting to see what look like the long string excitations that you see in the CFT emerging from the supergravity, but from a brain-like excitation that you can build in world sheet string theory. And so the picture that I would advocate is that, roughly speaking, what you've done is to take the 5-brains, and by building this spiral, you've sort of pulled the 5-brains apart. So they're in what's called a Coulomb phase in string theory. And so the five brains being apart is where you get these capped geometries that Samir and David and Yosef were talking about. But that the actual black hole degrees of freedom lie on these W-brain type objects, which are, they're in some sense the W bosons or matter degrees of freedom that are charged under the five-brain gauge dynamics. And so those charged objects are the analogs of W bosons or other charged matter, and in some sense, condensing them to make a black hole is like going to the Higgs branch of the field theory. So I would say that this process, this process of crossing, of starting with some smooth configuration, which is mostly Coulomb-like, and crossing over into the black hole regime, is like extrapolating through coherent excitation from a sort of an over-rotating phase to an under-rotating phase, but by continuing an object which is somehow dominated by the wrong excitations, and that that it's really these Higgs-dominated objects which are the black hole, the typical black hole states. So the emerging picture is that there's a regime of smooth sort of capped throat geometries, but it's separated from a black hole regime by some kind of phase transition where new degrees of freedom become light and turn on. At weak coupling, this is more or less similar to the standard picture of ADS5 and N equals 4 Yang-Mills, where the black hole is a liberation of the N squared gluons of the Yang-Mills theory. So this is very similar, except now the sort of W-like objects are not non-abelian gauge bosons, but they're these W strings. How much time do I have? 2 minutes, okay. Okay. So those degrees of freedom lead to a breakdown of the supergravity approximation. They're very stringy. They are the entropic degrees of freedom of the black hole. And for the last little bit, I'd like to argue that the scale of the wave function of these objects is the horizon scale consistent with the fuzzball picture. So it's the case that these objects, the tension of these W objects, when the brains start to get pushed together, is N5 times smaller than the tension of an ordinary string. And we know from work of Horowitz and Polchinski that when you have the horizon size being of order the string scale, that the wave function of a string accounts for the entropy of a black hole and the size of a black hole. So here we're in a situation now where there are two kinds of strings. There are ordinary fundamental strings out of which you and I are made, and then there are these W strings which are only liberated and light inside the black hole bound state. And they correspond to a tension scale and a wave function scale which is N5 times larger than the wave function of an ordinary string. So you can be nice and local, and the things that are actually making up the black hole are macroscopic. And that accounts for the difference between horizon scale physics and the entropy that has to reside there and the local physics that's seen by an infalling probe. So I think the thing I'd like to maybe finish with is that if you actually take seriously the entropy calculations and the comparison between the dual CFT and the space-time, then the inner horizon of the black hole has a walled entropy calculation. And if you ask how much entropy is carried there, it's all the entropy of the left-moving degrees of freedom minus the entropy of the right-moving degrees of freedom. The total entropy of the black hole is the sum of those two entropies. So that suggests that there's sort of twice the right-moving degrees of freedom somewhere in between the inner horizon and the outer horizon. And I would conjecture that those degrees of freedom are the wave function of the little string, which at extremality is sort of collapsed on the inner horizon equals the outer horizon because they're degenerate. And then when you start exciting the system away from extremality, you're extriding these string-like degrees of freedom and the wave function sort of puffs out a little bit. And so there are a few degrees of freedom that are oscillating away from the dominant collapsed bound state, and that accounts for the structure of a black hole. Now you could ask, how is this consistent with causality? And I would argue that causality is an effective notion that you get when you integrate out these degrees of freedom. It's not necessarily a property of the fundamental theory. So I would conjecture that, question of whether it's a firewall or a fuzzball or whatever, it's an issue of what's the response function of this string-like matter. Is it stiff when you bang on it? Then that's a firewall. If it's soft, then it looks maybe approximately like vacuum physics. And so it's really a question of, can we understand enough about the two-point function or other correlation functions of this matter that's dominating the typical black hole microstate in order to resolve this question? And I think maybe it's a good time to stop.
Questions?
So these W strings, do they stop at the horizon or do they venture out? I mean, they are light.
So the place where you actually have calculational control, it's where you pull the fibrains apart a little bit, okay, using the angular momentum. Okay? So when you pull them apart, then the W strings get some rest mass, which is how much you've stretched the fibrains, how much you've pulled apart the fibrains that they're stretching between. So it's just a standard thing, right? The rest tension is proportional to the separation between the fibrains. So on the Coulomb branch, where we have control over the geometry in perturbative string theory, that W string is its tension gets bigger and bigger the more angular momentum we give the thing. Okay? And so what you're not seeing is the black hole phase. You're seeing sort of a precursor of the black hole phase. You're seeing the objects which will become black holes being massive excitations in the wrong phase that become light and condense when you go to the black hole phase. So it's a little bit different picture than, you know, you've heard from earlier talks where everything's going to be geometry and we just have to understand, you know, balls of flux and stuff like that. And maybe that's just because I'm working in a different corner of the parameter space of the theory. But I strongly suspect that this sort of quantum stuff that Josef wants to not worry about is hiding the bulk of the microstates.
But I guess what I'm trying to do they stop at the horizon, near horizon? Can they?
No, there's a tail of the wave function.
Okay.
And so so you already see that in what I was saying before, that even if I just look at the wave functions of ordinary strings, not W strings, then the group theory model that we constructed has a tail of stringy states. The tail of the wave function goes like r to the minus n5. And so it pokes out of the horizon. It's just that it decays very rapidly. And so I think these typical states will have that structure as well, that you will only be able to distinguish it from a black hole state by some sort of multiple moments of supergravity that are like r to the minus q, where q is the integer charge carried by the black hole. So if the black hole is macroscopic, you're of course never going to see that. And so very close to, you know, until you get very close to the horizon, the thing's going to look like an ordinary black hole, and then there's some tail of the wave function that pokes out. Now, you know, you could ask, how is that consistent with, you know, what Samir is saying about, you know, some kind of fuzz? Well, just because that's how the wave function decays doesn't mean that there aren't virtual excitations, which if you bang on it hard enough, you can expose. And we know that's true in string theory, right? String theory, you say, okay, I have some string, okay? It's got some normal mode oscillations. Every one of those normal mode oscillations has a half h-bar omega of, you know, width. And so if you add up all of, you know, if you actually calculate what is the delta x squared of a string, adding up all the normal modes, it's infinity. So, you know, why don't I see, you know, why aren't the strings I'm made of, you know, infinite size spread all over the universe? It's because they're in some very precise ground state wave function, which is very coherent. And, you know, I don't detect this because most of its high frequency, you know, the high modes of the string are all in their ground state. They're oscillating very quickly. And until I do an experiment that probes, that resolves the energy scale of the high modes, I don't see it. So the physical question is, if I bang on it and I give it some momentum transfer delta E, I make some energy available to actually see that some modes are not in their ground state because I've hit them. And then all of a sudden I do see a string that has some big size. So I think the W string is gonna be like that, except replicated with some object which has a much lighter tension. So it takes much less energy to bang on it and see a size which is much bigger.
You draw this as if these were closed strings. Are the W string closed or open?
They're secretly membranes stretching between the five brains. So they're closed in the direction along the brain, and they're open in the direction between the brains. Right, so I have some five brain, I have another five brain, and I have a two brain that stretches between them. Okay, so when I push the brains apart by giving them some angular momentum, I make the rest mass of this object bigger by stretching it in this direction. But it's always stretched in this y direction, which is the angular direction of ADS3.
So in terms of counting, you treat them as open strings or closed string or something in between?
So I think the name of the game is going to be to, this is in the worldsheet approach, this is a D2 brain. And so it's going to be an issue of constructing the appropriate open string state, and then analyzing the spectrum of open strings on it, which are the momentum charge carriers.
My question about it is about the tunneling. So again, you know, in order for the structure of the horizon to be formed in a collapse, when you have somebody falling there, you know, if the structure doesn't descend all the way to the outer horizon, if the entropy is not visible at the outer horizon, but only at the inner horizon, there is no way for a shell to tunnel into this.
I don't think it needs to be tunneling. Tunneling is, so what's the argument? The argument is you have a macroscopic density of states, and you have matrix elements between states. So it doesn't necessarily have to be some kind of non-perturbative tunneling. What you really have is that there's a huge phase space and you're exploring it.
But there's a distance tunneling calculation, a distance between R plus and R minus. So, you know, if the shell arrives at R plus, if all the entropy leaves at R minus, by the time there's a huge hill to go over. So, you know, if you just do the tunneling calculation, at least, you know, for the examples which I know, if you do the tunneling calculation, there's a huge shift to go from R minus to R.
Horizons
costs a lot of probability.
Horizons are teleological objects. They're not locally determined, right? Mm-hmm. All you care about is that by the time you get here and you have enough energy that you've somehow gotten ensnared by this tangle of string. And once you get entangled with the tangle of string, you're drawn with it, like Gulliver being trapped by the Lilliputians, until you're inevitably drawn to here, where you're ripped apart. Okay. So as long as the object exists far enough out here, and again, just like the string, right? The stuff out here is in its ground state. You don't see it until you provide enough energy to see it. Providing enough energy to see it means pulling the horizon out to here. But then you've made these virtual string excitations into real string excitations, and there's stuff out there for you to get trapped by.
So before we think,
so going over the hill or going on the side?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I have a question for, well, I'm a terrible chair, so we should be for an hour.
We've got 5 minutes.
Maybe 2 minutes or 5 minutes. So I have a general question. The first is, so there should be generically an instability in these geometries. What's controlling? Is there a parameter there I know controls? Is this a generic feature?
Yeah, I actually had.
Do you know the time scale for this? And my second question, I think, which is important for people trying to think about observational consequences, is we have arguments that the material absorbs all wavelengths smaller than scales of the order of m. I mean, are there strong arguments for the reflectivity of this material? Do we know them? I mean, is this generic and solid?
So in answer to the first question, so this question about instability. So I think it largely has to do with whether the particular state you're looking at as your starting point is a typical state or not. Okay, if it's not a typical state, if it's a very coherently excited state, then the instability is towards evolving towards something more generic. Okay, so the timescales and other properties of the radiation have to do with what is the thermalization time of an atypical state. Okay. So if you're looking at something which is a few modes excited macroscopically, like these superstratum states, then they're allowed to be unstable, and they will evolve towards a more stable state.
Non-linear.
And the question is, so the question is, are those more generic states still geometrical, as Josef would argue, or are they more stringy, as I would argue? If they're more stringy, then you haven't captured the decay process and its endpoint by doing a supergravity calculation. So on the other hand, I mean, it's quite right, as David was saying, that the mechanism by which the thing de-excites from a conformal field theory point is exactly the same process. It's a left mover in the conformal field theory colliding with a right mover in the conformal field theory and emitting some graviton or other closed string state. So it's the same mechanism. The question is, where is it taking you within the state space? Now, whether any of this will have observational consequences, I have my doubts. But I think we're very far from having control over a calculation that's believable.
Can I give my version? So, first of all, again, if you look at the time scale, when you have linear instabilities, and you have non-linear instabilities, and you have linear instabilities. So you have non-linear instabilities, and you have supersymmetric solutions. This is what Santos and Oscar Diaz and Harvey Real and people have been doing.
Non-linear
instabilities. They are happening because you have a supersymmetric configuration. If it's supersymmetric configuration, it cannot be unstable. But nonlinear stability is basically the same as exciting it once, exciting it twice, and looking at what excitations are doing with respect to each other. And then you have instabilities, of course, because again you have only left movers which are supersymmetric. You put one right mover, and then you're looking at its back reaction. And of course, if you put the one right mover as a probe, you don't see anything. But if you look at the interaction, it starts talking to the left movers and emitting stuff. And from a CFT perspective, what's happening? There's a huge phase space. When you put some energy in the phase space, the poor guy wants to go somewhere in the phase space where there's more entropy. And, as Roberto was saying, there's a free energy, there's an entropic force driving you towards the more typical sectors of the CFT. So, for example, if you have a non-typical state like a super tube, which is huge, you put some energy into it, it wants to go to more typical regions.
Okay, but this is not an argument that you always mean it's Hawking like
radiation. So I think what you get from a CFT perspective is the same. So when you have a CFT dual in regions if you have an ADST geometry and some non-supersymmetric stuff at the bottom, whatever calculation you do there, it mimics Hawking radiation. So I think it will mimic Hawking radiation. The main thing to understand, I think the main puzzle is about the superposition and whether what's the real stuff which you observe? Is it going to be some decoherence, some quantum superposition of all these geometries or of all these W brains, or is it going to be one particular thing?
What about the absorption of this? Do you have any comments on that?
Absorption depends on the supertube. So supersymmetric ones have supertube. Supertube depends on an arbitrary function. So the modular space is given by an arbitrary function. So imagine we have a string which is tensionless. You hit it with anything, it just moves. So supertubes, unless you make them maximally spinning and you put a huge amount of angular momentum in them, they are very soft. There's a moduli space of them. Any function is a solution. So the moduli space is determined by the space of all functions. You put some energy, you just go around. There's no barrier for supersymmetric. The only barrier is if the state is long enough, there's some quantization and so on and so forth, but it's a quantization barrier, it's not anything classical. Now, that's what's happening for supersymmetric. When you go away from supersymmetry, for example, the solution which David and Bossard and Kalmadas are building, and the one that we built before, the way we build those is with bubbles. Bubble, bubble, bubble. Those, of course, bubbles have tension. There's a flux on them, there's an energy. If you hit it with some energy, you make it ring. If you hit it, some observers come in, they go out. Some other observers make the thing ring down. But we don't have enough of them. And we don't understand whether this moduli space of solutions and this infinite functional solutions that we have in the supersymmetric case, how do they go to the non-supersymmetric case? That's the really key missing thing. Because in the supersymmetric case, you know very well. You have functions of solutions, you count them. Okay, you have the W brains also, you have to do many things, but there's really all supersymmetric solutions, there's a huge moduli space. Once you put temperature, we don't understand what each and every one of those is doing. And whether they rigidify or not, for example.
I just had a question for you. You said that the probability of the shell going into some fuzzball gets to be unity when the shell gets out of the R equals 2n. How does it depend on R before R gets down to 2n?
So in our calculation, what we did, we took a shell of brains. So essentially, you can think about them as basically equal charge equals to mass fundamental objects. And we bring them, so they have a moduli space. They can move anywhere they want. And you can just bring them in. And there's a flat direction to bringing them in, but if you look at the momentum, there's a hill, actually. So you cannot, so actually depending on where you start from, there's a hill. So the further out you go, the harder it is to tunnel. You have to get within some region.
But I guess is that region like R, is there a significant probability you'll tunnel at R equals 3m, for example?
An extremal black hole, so it's a very different calculation than BPS ones. In the BPS solution, you have R equals 2m, R equals to 3m. An extremal black hole has an infinite throat. Then so the way you go on extremal, you go down up the throat. You bring the horizon up the throat. You still have the throat and you bring it up. So this is so it's not really R equals. I mean, it's hard to talk
For Schwarzschild one, you don't have it. You don't.
We don't have Schwarzschild one. No. I mean, you have a calculation with equal signs. Again, I'm advertising. We have really have the right number. There's factors of two right. I mean, this is it's a calculation done it's only extremal. That's the only place where we can compute. It's not a probe calculation. No, it's actual calculation. You bring deep rays and you bring them in a bubbling geometry, and then the X-ray can tunnel from one to the other one. It's the same as brain flux annihilation. It's exactly brain flux annihilation for fluxon quantification. It's the same calculation, getting Kaczor-Pearson Belinde from ages ago. This is really the same calculation. There's a hill, and you can tunnel into a supersymmetric solution, which is a bubble, and then another one, and another one, and another, and you can just tunnel all of them. You multiply all the tunneling probabilities, and you compare to e to the minus s. And you get more. This is the thing which is shocking, You get more, If I had gotten equal numbers, I would have said, okay, great, it happens exactly the way Samir wants, and the horizon and the tunnel. But no, you actually get, even when the shell is bigger, you actually get that you can tunnel into them. But if the shell is too far away, you cannot.
Let's thank you, Ilan, all the support.